Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Whatever time you're listening to this, wherever you're listening to this, this is Greg Klein's Old School Wrestling Talk, episode 37, the summer of 69, part 2. How are you guys? December 1st, 2023, the end of 2023. It cannot end any quicker, but I will be happy to see it go. It's been a good year. It's been a bad year, as you guys know. But it's been a great year for discovering stuff about professional wrestling and the sport that we love, especially the history of it. And we're going to go through a lot of it today because, as probably you predicted, I did not watch January of 1983 Mid-South Wrestling Association during the holiday while we were away for Thanksgiving. But going through my Houston wrestling collection and thinking about the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame and what needs to be done for the candidacies of Morris Siegel and Sylvester Ritter, aka the Junkyard Dog, I've been looking at a lot of wrestling history and I've got a lot of stuff on my mind today. And will WWF main event end with the main event, which is a Summer of 69 program that I just acquired sort of by accident from September 19th, 1969 in Houston, Texas, that features Johnny Valentine challenging Dory Funk Jr. for the NWA title. However, in true Houston fashion, it's the match next week that has all the attention, because even when the NWA champion leaves town, Houston wants to be able to sell out their arena, and boy, do they, and do they have a great thing planned for September 26th, 1969, which is actually my birthday and which would actually be 1 year before I was born. So almost a gleam in my father's eye, as you might say. And I think they were trying at that point in time. So that if that doesn't give you an uncomfortable feeling about my parents, Jeff and Jennifer, then I don't know what will. But how are you guys? It's great to speak with you again, and it's great to come back after last month's little Evad Mizell Zizzers controversy and Hall of Fame tit for tat. But like I said, it's going to be a great show. As always, Greg Klein's Old School Wrestling Talk is brought to you by me, Greg Klein, and my published works. Still working on that set of plays, or my first two plays, I guess is how I would frame it. But in the meantime, you can get the biography of the Junkyard Dog, the King of New Orleans, on Amazon, and even still in some bookstores, as brought to you by ECW Press. And then my first novel, The Paper Tigers, the untold true story about how 8 guys from the streets of Philadelphia became professional baseball players for one day. And it is a true story, but it's historic fiction in my retelling of it. It's all about the day that Ty Cobb jumped into the stands in New York, nearly killed a crippled fan that called him the N-word. As a result, Cobb is suspended. His team goes on strike, which is not what you would expect from the Detroit Tigers and Ty Cobb. And in retaliation, manager Huey Jennings has to go to the streets of Philadelphia and field a scab team. And this is all about their game, their one game as pros against the world champion Philadelphia A's. So that is available on Amazon. And if you are interested in either book autographed from me, reach out and I'll tell you how to either PayPal me or Cash App me, which I think are the two apps that I have for the money things at the moment. In any event, no more commercials. Let's get to this month's episode. We're going to do a few things, and then we will end, admittedly, with an R-rated story. So this is your first of 3 trigger warnings. If you've got kids listening with you, do not let them hear this story. If you are of, say, delicate sensibilities, do not listen to the end of this podcast. This is a sure enough Ernie Ladd R-rated story, and it came secondhand from somebody who was, in this case, Mr. Announcer, and witnessed this firsthand, and the punchline is, I can't do Ernie's accent well enough to really make it sizzle, but somebody tell this story to Jim Cornette, and he'll do it with the right accent, right? I never met Ernie Ladd, so I know the people that were around him could mimic him better than I can, and I can't do, and we've talked about in terms of New Orleans, there's probably 25 to 50 different dialects and accents just in New Orleans and New Orleans extended, you know, let alone Texas and Northern Louisiana and different parts of the South. And then obviously, you know, in this day and age to mimic other people's accents, especially when they're different races or different nationalities, can be a dicey game. But as an actor, I love to do accents, and I wish that I could do Ernie's better. And it is an R-rated story, so I might as well try to do the accent as well. And if it offends you, don't listen to the last, say, 2 minutes of the show, maybe 3 minutes of the show. And of course, we'll end with a promise that next time we will do Mid-South, January 1983, which I do want to get to. I'm a little leery to get into 83, knowing it's a long, hard slog until we get to the golden era, which is when Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express show up. And I was thinking, when does this silver era that we've been in for the last 6 months end? And I think much like the golden era, the silver era ends when the tag team titles get compromised by substitute partners. And I think for the same reason, like DiBiase or the other partner, in this case, Olympia, or, you know, Matt Bourne, when the partners leave and then are replaced, that starts to be a little bit of the end of the era. And in this case, I think it lasts all the way through Olympia turning on Two and Dog, and Olympia becoming DiBiase's tag team partner, because it's still this same feud that's really going strong for almost a year. And then when that feud finally dies and DiBiase finally leaves, that's the end of that era. But, I mean, you could argue that it's when Boris Zherkov starts teaming with DiBiase as part of the picture, or when, you know, Johnny Rich becomes Hacksaw Duggan's surprise, get the pin tag team partner, which was a nice angle, but, you know, isn't the same as later on in the year when Magnum gets elevated to that spot, and then Magnum gets elevated with Mr. Wrestling 2 again. And that, of course, happens when the Midnight Express show up. So that is the golden era. There has to be some sort of lull in between. We all know the lull that happens in the fall of 1983, and I don't put it on Mike Jackson because he won a match, but, you know, as you guys know, I do credit Mike Jackson with being the guy that got beat up by both the Midnight Express and the Road Warriors, and we talked about that on Twitter. Now, in addition to the Ernie Ladd story to end the show and the 1969 program, we'll build up to it with a couple of other things. First of all, the Wrestling Hall of Fame, which, using the Hall of Fame stat tracker, I was able to guess 4 of the 7 inductees, and that was Sergeant Slaughter, Rocca and Perez as a tag team, the Beauty Pair from Japan, the women's tag team, and Blue Panther from Mexico. The ones I missed on, I got the wrong Briscoe brothers, and even in the final days, looking at the stat tracker and how the stats changed right up until the last minute, I thought maybe I was going to miss on the modern Briscoe brothers for the Young Bucks. I thought the Young Bucks were actually trending in. As it turns out, the Wrestling Tracker did a pretty good job in the same way that the Baseball Tracker does a good job. I didn't realize, and this is my bad, my ignorance of not paying enough attention to what, you know, Crazy Uncle Dave is doing, but I didn't realize that the threshold was 60%. So actually the Hall of Fame tracker for baseball and wrestling did work pretty similar to one another in its final estimate, in that a lot of the controversial picks or picks that might expose writers to some scrutiny get held back. And so people dive a little bit, 5 to 10 to 20%. You know, in the case of Junkyard Dog, it really looked like he was trending in the last couple of days, and then he ended up at about 40%. So a lot of people that didn't pick him either held their ballots back on purpose, which is what happens in baseball. Like, if you don't pick Derek Jeter and he's not 100%, or, you know, maybe that happens with Ichiro Suzuki, where somebody that doesn't want him on the first ballot or doesn't want him 100% will hold their ballot back, and you never see it before the induction announcement. But in this case, Junkyard Dog sort of dove. You know, when we recorded this last month, I was really excited about him. And Paul Orndorff, who still seems to be trending in, and Morris Siegel, who also dove. So, you know, we'll talk a little more over the year. And obviously, I'm going to do a lot of work on this, but I've already started. What I've decided to do is now work within the system a little bit and not just rant or agitate about Dave and the Junk Food Dog, or Dave and the need for a veterans committee. You know what I realized is even a veterans committee is relying on Dave picking the right people to be on the veterans committee. So, you know, that's no guarantee. So what I'd like to do for my candidates, and you guys know, they're Morris Siegel and the Junkyard Dog, and probably at some point we'll take on Wild Bill Curry as well. You know, just because it's got that Houston slant to it. But at some point this year, I'm going to put together 2 or 3 or 4, whatever it takes, page talking points and start to really disseminate them, for lack of a better word, amongst you guys, amongst the wrestling historian, wrestling nostalgia, wrestling territory loving communities, so that you guys can then signal blast them and pass them along to your people and to other people that you know that I don't know, or you might be friends with that I'm not friends with, you know, that are also voters in this Hall of Fame thing, whether they be retired wrestlers, current wrestlers, wrestling historians, or just Dave-worthy fans. And, you know, I keep thinking that I'll maybe Evad Mizell-Zeltzer will catch on. It's a little klutzy to say. Evad is, of course, you know, a reverse of Dave, which is the 1990s horrible Kevin Sullivan booking. Kevin Sullivan was such a good booker on some levels, and then on some levels it's like, let's just create a Gary Hart-like heel faction for Hulk Hogan to beat up, which I guess was his job at the time. I shouldn't really say anything bad about it. But anyway, Evad. And then for those of you that don't know Carney, most of Carney, and I, you know, your mileage may vary and there might be different dialects. I never spoke Carney. And I was thinking of this story about one of the ribs that I endured getting into the business, which involved me meeting Grizzly Smith. So I'll tell that story at some point. But my larger point was just mostly Carney was spoken around me, and often it was spoken around me because they were about to play a rib on me. And you could almost hear Grizzeg, you know, like, wait, what was that? That almost sounds like my name. But anyway, so Carney, a lot of Carney is just sort of Pig Latin or something similar to Pig Latin, but with is or some similar, you know, things stuck in between. So Mizell-Zeltzer, I think, is, you know, Evad Mizell-Zeltzer. But it's a little klutzy to say, and I don't want to poke the beast. I, you know, like I said, I'm sorry Dave can't take criticism, and I wish that we could speak to him directly about the Hall of Fame a little bit and maybe change his mind about how to do things a little bit and maybe take some responsibility for things like the junk food dog slur that might be affecting Sylvester Ritter. But instead, what I'm going to do is put together these sheets for Morris Siegel and Sylvester Ritter. And at some point in the new year, I'll start to pass them out, especially, you know, at first to the people that I know a little better. I won't even say closer, but just because I've had more interaction with them, you know, Ben and Mark and Al Getz and people like that. And then we'll just work our way outward and sort of see if we can get these ideas in people's heads. And I'm just going to start the day and start this episode with a couple of examples that I've been looking into that have made me go, wow. And, you know, in one case, in the Junkyard Dog case, it's something that we've talked about on the show, but I'm really starting to crystallize it in my mind as to how this worked. And I think it's a big deal. When we're talking about the Junkyard Dog, first and foremost, we're talking about his role in the city of New Orleans, right? Well, Al Getz was talking the other day about the fact that, you know, when people talk about New Orleans in the Leroy McGuirk era, they're not really talking about New Orleans. And only people in southern Louisiana probably get this distinction, but they're talking about a suburb, so to speak, of New Orleans called Chalmette in St. Bernard Parish. Now, in some ways, this is a distinction without a difference. This is the New Orleans market. Like, when they go down to Chalmette, they're running New Orleans. But it's not New Orleans. It's a whole different parish. And for those of you that are not in Louisiana, a parish is their version of a county. And it's a whole different city. It's Chalmette. It's not New Orleans. It's the county. I thought it was south at first, but looking at the map, it's really, I think it's better to think of it as east. And they're both east of the Mississippi River. And because sometimes people are using the Mississippi River as a measuring point, it can get really confusing. And the way that I explain it is I married into a New Orleans family, but they're a West Bank family. And the West Bank is obviously the West Bank of the Mississippi. It's also the West Bank of Jefferson Parish because they were in the next county over from New Orleans, not on the Chalmette side, that's the other side, on the east side. This is on the west side, but Jefferson Parish actually is on both sides of the river. It's just to the north and to the west and to the south of the city of New Orleans, if that makes sense. But the weird thing is, we were on the west bank, but when we were leaving New Orleans proper, the city, we'd go over the bridge and head due south over the river to the west bank of the river, due south to where we lived on the west bank. Very confusing, I know. Anyway, so here's the thing. In the Bill Watts era of McGurk wrestling, and then when Bill Watts takes over the territory, what we might think of as the Dick Murdoch era of New Orleans wrestling, they're running in Chalmette, in the St. Bernard Civic Center, in St. Bernard Parish. And I told this joke last episode. I did a film there in almost 10 years ago now, and it was a trailer, and it was with a group that of filmmakers that included a husband and a wife who lived right in Chalmette. And he kept making this joke about, you know, she's the first Chalmatian, which is, I guess, what they called people from Chalmette, that I ever met that had all her teeth. So I decided to marry her. And she'd get angry and she'd say, "Stanley, I'm not from Chalmette." And they're not married anymore. So go figure. But I mean, that's kind of what St. Bernard Parish was. It's, you know, to really just spell it out, it's the poor white neighborhood right next to the poor black neighborhood. And in this case, Chalmette is literally about 4 miles east of Treme. Treme is where the downtown municipal auditorium is. So think about this. When they go from Dick Murdoch to Junkyard Dog as the big star sometime, and we'll have to nail this time exactly down, but sometime in 79 or 1980, they move to an entirely new arena in a different part of town that is much more suited for their new star, Sylvester Ritter, the Junkyard Dog. And that's why the Downtown Municipal Auditorium, which is in a historic complex just outside of the French Quarter, just over the line, so to speak, if there is such things in what we would call Treme, and in a complex that has incredible history for music and art and wrestling. And it's the building in New Orleans that they run for the next 5 years, give or take, until two things happen. In early 1984, Mr. Wrestling 2 botches the knee lift. Junkyard Dog sells it anyway and goes down like a, you know, Junkyard Dog, like he always does, the Tim Burr. 2 wins the North American title, and we talk about that as the knee lift that killed New Orleans. But it didn't kill New Orleans. It killed the Dog's Yard, and that's what they called it. It killed the Downtown Municipal Auditorium. But the other thing that killed it is then Junkyard Dog leaves in June of 1984, and no shows, a bunch of shows along the way. But here's the thing. In some ways, 1984 is all about this changeover in Mid-South, where New Orleans is no longer becoming the center of the territory, and Tulsa and Oklahoma City is the center of the territory, and the star is moving from being a Junkyard Dog territory to being a Hacksaw Duggan territory. Now, that only lasts till the beginning of 1986. It's not as long, but it doesn't kill New Orleans. You know what they do? They move about 5 miles north. Technically, I think it's still in the city of New Orleans, but it's really like a suburb along Lake Pontchartrain at the university, UNO Lakefront Arena. And that's where DiBiase versus Duggan with all the stips takes place. And yeah, New Orleans is not the best town for that, but that did fine. And the Rock and Roll Express do great. And Magnum becomes a star, and Terry Taylor becomes a star. And they're still hot in New Orleans, probably until 85 or 86, when, you know, in an R-rated way, somebody realizes that you can't even get a hooker on Canal Street anymore. And that's because people didn't have disposable income when the oil industry goes boom. So that's one of the talking points about Sylvester Ritter as a star. He had his own building in New Orleans. They specifically moved there for him, And when he's no longer a star there, they have to move away there for the next guy. And yes, all of those moves are precipitated because of the skin color of the star. But another way of saying it would be like of the gimmick of the star, you know? And it's not any different than like promoting Madison Square Garden with an ethnic champion. You know, this was the first time, and this is again a talking point about Sylvester Ritter. This is the first time a territory has said, you, over there, you are our star of the show. And we're going to have a black superhero, and we're going to promote you as the star of the territory. And oh, by the way, it's the Deep South, where until you study the demographics, you can't even imagine why they would do it there, given everything you've heard about the Deep South. But then you realize that Mississippi is 35% black, and Jackson is probably 65 or 70% black, and New Orleans at times is over 70% black. And you go, oh, okay, and Louisiana is like 30% black. So then you think about it, and you think about, and not only did they do it, but they found the right building to do it in. They found the right neighborhood to do it in, and they switched three different buildings within a 10-mile radius of the same city, and not the biggest city in America, right? This is not New York or Boston or Chicago. This is not the biggest Canadian cities like Toronto or Montreal. This isn't even as big as Houston. This is a city that's like 150, 200, 250,000 people, maybe a little more when you expand out into the parishes. This is one of the smallest cities in like the NBA, NFL arc. This is small market compared to what a lot of territories have. And this is what they built on. And then, of course, as you guys know, and we'll document this too, Houston, which becomes their biggest market. The only reason Tulsa and Oklahoma City are the center later is because Watts lives there. It was the original center of the territory when it was McGurk's, and it's two cities in a double shot, so you're drawing double the crowds to two big arenas, right? But Houston, you know, with its 10 or 12,000 seat arena, is your biggest market once you pick it up. And why do you pick it up? Well, we can go back. We've talked about this before too. You look at the territory, you look what's happening at the time. In 1982, Southwest Sports has flatlined in Houston. Flatlined in Houston. And who's the other biggest star? Well, in June of 1982, what happens? The silver era of Mid-South Wrestling is happening. And everybody in East Texas is getting this. It's bleeding over the border from Louisiana. Like, you can see this. There's overlap in what would be a Houston Astros fan base market and a New Orleans Saints fan base market. Houston and New Orleans are like intertwined in hurricane lore and in cultural lore. And like New Orleans, even though Houston's very southern, it's also very Catholic compared to the rest of the South. And some of that, of course, is because of being a partially Hispanic city, but some of it's also part, you know, being part African city and different ways that Catholicism spread through Africa. So it's like, it's very different than a typical big South city in some ways, but very similar to New Orleans. So there is like this synergy between these two markets. And of course, Pete Burkles, who is Paul Bosch's nephew, and at some points really the driving force in the 80s pre-merger, you know, in terms of the changes in Houston wrestling, pre-merger with Mid-South, I mean, you know, Pete Burkles is also promoting Beaumont and Port Arthur, which are border towns that then bleed into the Mid-South market and vice versa. So who is the big star in the middle of 1982 in Houston? It's the Junkyard Dog. And think about this too. He's getting these shots at Nick Bockwinkel. He has one match where Bobby Heenan counts to three and tricks Dog into thinking he's won the match, you know, thinking that the referee counted to three. He has one match where I think Heenan is barred. They have the squash match. Obviously, that's a non-title match. You know, that might be in 83 when Bockwinkel loses the title at one point, or 82 when he loses it to Wands. You know, we've documented all the Nick Bockwinkle stuff, but my point is this is all happening during the switchover. And Junkyard Dog is the biggest star at that time. Another thing that I was thinking about, when Junkyard Dog is in the WWF, right? This is always a knock on him. Think about when he jumps. He jumps in the summer of 1984, and over the next 3 or 4 years, is the B or C show star headliner, right? He wins the Wrestling Classic in 86 over Randy Savage, who is a huge rising star at the time, but Junkyard Dog is the face. So he won the event, right? And that's in Chicago. He's, you know, against Valentine in WrestleMania 1. He's with Terry Funk in a, you know, against Terry Funk and Dory Funk and in a huge match with Tito Santana that otherwise is on Saturday night's main event with Hulk Hogan instead of Santana. So he's all over Saturday night's main event. He's all over the first couple of WrestleManias, and it's not till 3 and 4 that his stock is going down. So, you know, when you talk about the Junkyard Dog, you're not really talking about him being a big star for 5 years. You're talking about him being a big star for the whole decade of the 80s. And again, think about this. We talked about this in my book. Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas could have been picked to be Bill Watts' big star. Johnson is a huge star in Texas in the 70s. He's a huge star throughout the Southeast in the 70s. His gimmick is that he's an athlete, not a wrestler. He's a boxer and a fighter and an athlete. And then Tony Atlas is a huge star on the Superstation in the 1979-1980 era when cable is just spreading everywhere. So everybody knows Mr. USA. When Tony Atlas does come in to Mid-South, they chant for the Junkyard Dog. And when the Junkyard Dog comes into the WWF, he's going to be positioned as the top ethnic star in the black category, right? I mean, that's Vince's mindset, I have to think, is what he's doing at this point. He already has Rocky Johnson, and he already has Tony Atlas. And in fact, Tony Atlas is getting pushed down the cards in 1985 to the point where he does a job in Madison Square Garden for Paul Orndorff the month before WrestleMania. And if he had made the WrestleMania card, he was going to job for Bundy. Junkyard Dog wrestled Greg Valentine for the Intercontinental title. And of course, he won by DQ. Going into a year-long feud with Jimmy Hart and the Funks, that is all over Saturday night's main event when they get the NBC spot. It's not Rocky Johnson, who's on his way out or gone. It's not Tony Atlas, who's unreliable. And Tony Atlas looks great in this era. He looks more pumped up on steroids than ever. He's got the weird thing where he loses his hair, you know, or shaves his head in 1985, which might be a sign of being erratic or, you know, it was also a prelude to the Junkyard Dog losing a little bit of his charisma in the 90s without his afro, right? But Tony Atlas looks huge. He just can't be relied on. And, you know, obviously we know that that happens to Sylvester later on in his career. But my point is just, you know, this is what the talking points are going to be. Just more stuff. And we'll verify everything that we can. And then also, we're going to give it to other historians, obviously, as part of this thing. So that way, you know, we can have some of the claims sort of looked at. And, Al Getz has convinced me that we're never going to have all the stats. We're never going to have all the attendance figures. It's never going to be a level playing field. We'll never really know what the collective attendance was of the Downtown Municipal Auditorium from 79 or 80 through June of 84, or what the highs and lows were. I can accept that. You know, somewhere out there, we have all the Houston figures, I think. Anyway. So that's the Junkyard Dog. Now, the Morris Siegel stuff is fascinating, and I've just been going wow all day today and yesterday because I just finished all the Morris Siegel sections in the Pete Burkle's book, and now I'm looking at a lot of the sections in the Tim Hornbaker, you know, book about the National Wrestling Alliance. And here's the thing that made me go, or made me go, wow, and it's about Lou Thesz. In the 1940s, now think about Morris Siegel. His brother Julius opens the Houston market to wrestling in the early 1920s. Morris gets involved in the mid-1920s, and then by about 28, Julius moves on to promote some of those, you know, northern Louisiana and Texas border towns and open them up as wrestling and boxing markets. And Morris takes over as the sole wrestling promoter in what becomes, what did they call it? Was it also the Gulf Athletic Club? In the beginning, I think it just says Morris P. Siegel promoter, but there's a lot of different names, as we know, over the course of time for the promotion. But Morris Siegel ends up having it for almost 40 years, from the late 1920s until his death in late 1966. And he was a Luthez loyalist in the 1940s. You know, by this point, he's in business for 20 years. The NWA, as we know it, is formed amongst the Midwest promoters, you know, circa 1948. So in 1949, there are two world champions. There's Luthez's contingency and there's Orville Brown's contingency. And there's also a promotional war in St. Louis between Luthez's promotion and Sam Mushnick's promotion. And apparently, if I'm reading my Tim Hornbaker correctly, Luthez and Sam Mushnick both, quote unquote, accidentally are in Houston in July of 1949. And Lou asks, and there's a little bit of passive subject in this paragraph by Hornbaker, but we can look into his sources and things like that. Lou asks for a meeting. Now, who does he ask? It's not explicitly said, but the assumption is he asks Morris Siegel, who has been friends with Mushnick and who is being approached by the NWA cartel for membership. Not only do they want him, but they want his contacts in Texas. And remember that Morris Siegel is running the Texas booking office in addition to being the promoter in Houston. So Luthez asks for a meeting. Apparently, the wall comes down is the way that Hornbaker phrases it. And it's worked out that Lou will come into the fold. He'll merge his St. Louis promotion with Sam Mushnick. And he and Orville Brown will have a unification match. Now, in November, Orville Brown has a car accident that ends his career. And the NWA instead recognizes Luthez as the champion. In 1950, in 1949, at the second convention, Morris Siegel and several other Texas promoters become members of the NWA. Siegel is reported to be, by Hornbaker, the 10th member of the NWA. So what started with three and then four and then five Midwestern promoters in Des Moines and Omaha and then Kansas City and Minneapolis and then St. Louis has now spread to Texas, among other places. So the next year, 1950, with Luthez now on board as champion, Sam becomes president at the third convention, and Morris Siegel becomes vice president. This is the first year of Sam booking the champion. And if there's a problem between him and Thez, who do you think they're going to call? Well, maybe the guy that brokered the deal, right? Maybe the guy that already was a Thez loyalist, but also knows Sam and probably has known him for 10 or 15 years now, because they're, you know, not rival promoters, but they're both in the same business at a time when the business is learning to work together and finding any legal way to do it. So anyway, I thought that was really interesting. And then from that, one of the things I learned in the Pete Burkle's book was about the Parade of Champions. And I just put it out real quickly on Twitter and didn't let people answer for very long because I was all manic on new information. But it was like, when do you think the Parade of Champions happened for the first time? And who do you guys think of as developing the Super Show? And, you know, my answer was, like most people's, Dallas in the 80s. And, well, I thought that everybody got the concept from their mentor, Eddie Graham, right? Well, of course, we know Eddie Graham got a lot of his stuff from his mentor, Dory Funk Sr. Dory Funk Sr. got a lot of his stuff from Doc Sarpolis, if I'm saying his name right. Well, guess who was running mates and buddies as promoters with Doc? Guess who developed the Texas title with Doc? Morris Siegel. Guess who ran the Houston and Texas, the Houston promotion and the Texas booking office? Morris Siegel. So here's the thing. Pete Burkles mentions that Morris Siegel ran the first Parade of Champions in 1961. And it's funny how once you start to find one, the floodgates opens, because Brian Last and Jim Cornette were looking at a 1968 Parade of Champions in Buffalo. Looks like a St. Louis program because it's got that same script for the logo, but it's Buffalo. But here's the thing again. Morris Siegel did it in a 4,000-seat auditorium in January of 1961, and it probably was because he had to skip a week or he had skipped a couple of weeks for Christmas and wanted to come back with a bang, which is one of the things he apparently pioneered in his federation. And obviously, the television era is the 1950s. Morris Siegel gets TV in 1949. His lead announcer has just suffered a career-ending injury. His name is Paul Bosch. He's in the Hall of Fame for his 20 years at the helm of Houston wrestling. But Morris Siegel had it for 40 years, and he pioneered the TV. And he came up with the Parade of Champions Super Show concept. And here's the funny thing about that. So they do this show, and I put it on Twitter, and I think also on Greg Klein's Old School Wrestling Talk Facebook page already. 11 days after he does it in Houston with more or less the same card, all title matches, opened by a brass knuckles title match with Bill Curry. They do the same show, pretty much the same show, in Irving, Texas, at Texas Stadium. 1961, January 31st, 1961. Southwest Sports, Ed McLemore, but using Texas wrestlers from the Texas booking office, using pretty much the exact same card that they did at the City Odd in Houston a few days earlier, 11 days earlier. And then they do it again in 63. And then when Fritz takes over from McLemore, they bring it back in the 70s, including the Parade of Champions. That's the biggest crowd in Texas history, 24,000. Fritz and Dory Von Erich, 60-minute draw. And that holds up until the Parade of Champions that we all know, where Kerry wins the title from Flair in front of like 32 or 33,000 in 1984. That all started with Morris Siegel's Parade of Champions. Can you imagine? Like, how is he not in the Hall of Fame? So we're going to do a lot of that over this next year. And you know what's cool is I also found a Paul Bosch Parade of Champions. I don't have the week of the Parade of Champions, but in fine Houston tradition, I stumbled across the week before. So I have the one that's hyping it up. And sure enough, May 22nd, 1970, it's hyping May 30th, 1970. And you guys can recognize what's wrong with that pattern if you know Houston wrestling. Those shows are 8 days apart. Well, Morris Siegel established that this was a Friday night town every Friday night, and that way people did not get out of the habit. He would even run his TV tapings on Friday nights. If he couldn't get his main arena, he'd run an arena that he knew wasn't going to draw, you know, in a different part of town, and run it as a TV taping just so he could continue and say, I ran every Friday night. Well, in this case, Paul Bosch could not get the Coliseum on a Friday night. There wasn't any alternatives at that moment. So he ran a Saturday show on Saturday, May 30th, and called it the Parade of Champions. And sure enough, I mean, right inside is the, you know, banner headline, Parade of Champions. Like, there's no doubt about it. So I thought that was pretty cool and something that I learned in starting this research about Morris Siegel. So before we get to the main event, one more update. I had a really great conversation with John Cosper about his Tracy Smothers book. And the story that I still think is not true or is relayed the wrong way about Tracy getting the better of Adrian Street in a fight. So to those of you that have not been here for the three or four times I've talked about it, when Adrian died, or starting when Adrian died, I read Tracy Smothers' book, you know, which I thought was really good. If you don't buy this book, Everybody Dies, which admittedly was ghostwritten by John Cosper, who is a great writer, a great historian. I love his Wahoo McDaniel book. Can't wait to see his Judy Breyer's book. And he really loves, I think, the Blue Panther book. So, you know, great writer. Check out his stuff. He's done a lot of stuff. Other than Kenny Casanova, he's probably the prolific wrestling biographer writer that's out there right now. And I say that as the guy who wrote the Junkyard Dog book, you know, so all props to the two of them. And we had a great conversation. Whereas, you know, the Evad Mizzelzizers of the world can be a little touchy about their history. I don't think I was that way with Al Getz when he had a question for me that I still haven't answered, but am working on. And John was not that way with me at all. So here, I'm just going to read because I think it's really illustrative of both the historic research process and how hard it is to write a book on somebody, especially wrestlers who are known for tall tales and not remembering their thousands of matches over dozens of years. But also how we as historians, we as journalists can confirm facts and can admit if something we did was a little wrong and our desire to fix it. So I asked if I could ask him about the Adrian Street story, and he said yes. And I wrote, I am trying to confirm it, but no one seems to know that one. It seems very Adrian and Linda, very un-Adrian and Linda-like. I trained at Skullcrushers. And the timeline doesn't work because I am not sure when they overlapped in Alabama. Adrian loses a loser leave town match to Dutch in early 87 before Steve and Tracy arrive. So that means they crossed paths in Memphis in 85 or 88 maybe. Plus Bo James said Tracy loved Adrian and Linda and he never told him that story. And I apologize, I didn't, for those of you that haven't heard. So the story in the book is that Linda is flirting with Tracy in Alabama in 87. Adrian gets jealous. They tussle. It's never clear where, in the ring, out of the ring, outside, inside, locker room, in the bar. You know, it's never clearly stated where. Adrian is maybe getting the better of Tracy, but then he goes for the eye. And Tracy gets angry and punches his way out of it. And the implication is that Tracy punches Adrian silly, like knocks him out. Now, again, I might be reading into it, but you guys know. I mean, I think Adrian is one of the top 10 toughest guys in the business. Maybe five, but definitely 10. And nobody ever got the better of Adrian. And Adrian, well, you'll hear. So anyway, so I've been doubting this story and trying to confirm it. And Bo James said, well, you know, Tracy didn't write that book. And, you know, furthermore, Tracy never said a cross word about Adrian, and I've never heard the story. And Tracy lived with Bo at times. They traveled together. Everybody seems to love Tracy except my boy Murray the referee, and they did make up at the end, and I'll tell that story again someday. But in the interim, you know, the people that love Tracy never heard this story, really. So I wanted to know how John heard it. So here's what he says. Thanks for sharing. Tracy and I were working on his book when he was going through chemo the first time. We did phone calls one or two times a week, usually while he was doing treatments. Tracy went year by year, writing things down to share with me in between sessions. I don't recall specifically when he shared that story with me, but it would have been in one of those sessions, which I still have saved on a hard drive. Tracy also read through the book a few times before it went to print, taking out some stories that he didn't want included, so this made the cut. That being said, it's entirely possible Tracy told the story out of sequence, or he might have been misremembering something that happened to someone else or with someone else. I will tell you, Tracy had a lot of recall and accuracy up until the point he took that really hard chair shot. Tracy would go for an hour or 2 hours each week, just covering 1 year. At that point, he'd cover 2 to 4 years in the same time period of talking. Tracy did speak well of Adrian as recorded in the book, and he didn't have any beef with him at all that I can recall. So I wrote, makes sense, which it did. And at that point, I will tell you guys, what I concluded was that this didn't happen in Alabama. If this happened, it happened in Memphis, or, you know, it happened on an indie show, but it didn't happen in Continental for reasons we've discussed. They don't overlap in 1987 that we can find. Continental records are always a little shady, a little sketchy, a little incomplete. Anyway, so here's what I said back. It makes sense. I can't flat out not believe it because everyone knows Tracy was tough. But no one ever got the better of Adrian. Not picking fights was his entire MO. And the lesson number one at Skull Crushers. And Linda flirting to piss Adrian off sounds like a worked angle. And John writes back, that makes sense as well. I will say if I find out something's inaccurate or wildly off base, I'm not opposed to going in and editing after the fact. And I said, yeah, me too. And I won't say, you know, my other thoughts on the Junkyard Dog book at the moment, but we talked about that a little. We talked about Wahoo McDaniel a little. And I said, I forgot we were Facebook friends when I started discussing this on my podcast after Adrian died, so I wanted to ask at the source. And then John gave sort of his MO about being a historic researcher. And he said, my sole priority with each book is to make the subject and or their family happy. It's all about telling the story the way they want it told. This was Tracy's book and told his way. But again, I'm not opposed to correcting historical record if something comes up. So I thought that that was very good, and that's the way I feel as well, and that's what we're trying to do with some of the stuff in the Junkyard Dog book, including the thing that Al Getz is wondering, which, just to go back and summarize a little bit, is whether the Culkins were really racist or not, and whether, you know, the Culkin father, Gil's father, was, you know, really the ire of Sylvester Ritter, the Junkyard Dog, or whether it was a little bit of a work. And, you know, as we said, if we can find those interviews from that era, 1981, 1982, when Mississippi comes back in the fold and the Culkins come back in the fold, maybe it's even a little earlier. Maybe it's 1980. I'd have to go back and read the Culkin book again. But, you know, here's what Al thinks, I think, without saying it. And what I think is probably true as well is that it's all coming from the same source. And wherever I got that information from was probably Meltzer, who probably got it from Jim Ross, who probably got it from Bill Watts, who's probably, so, you know, it's the fruit, it's the poison fruit of the same tree, essentially, if it's poison. Now, the caveat is, who knows what's in their hearts? You know, we can't really say if he was racist or not racist. We can only say the circumstantial evidence, which is, these are the words he used, these are the deeds he did, and again, they don't always match up. Like, Bill Watts, for all we know, could have racism in his heart, but he's also the libertarian that promoted the Junkyard Dog as his big star, and that was revolutionary, not just in the Deep South, where it was seemingly unthinkable until you think about it, but also in America at that time, nobody had ever done it in a territory system. Anyway, so as we talked about, that's the update on Tracy Smothers versus Adrian Street. And did they really have a shoot fight that Tracy won? How could that be? I mean, we know how it could be. And Tracy tells how it would happen. But it just sounds work to me and not a shoot. And I think maybe they got it confused. Or I don't think that Tracy really punched out Adrian because Adrian went for his eye. And I don't think Linda was flirting with Tracy to make Adrian mad unless it was on TV in a worked angle. So anyway, that's the update on that. Thank you, John Cosper. That's the Hall of Fame stuff. Oh, I guess I should say the other people that got into the Hall of Fame it's not right in front of me. Let me pull up the Hall of Fame tracker. So the one obviously we didn't get was George Kidd. Thought that somebody else from the non-wrestlers category was going to make it in. Tomohiro Ishii, you can do the Jim Cornette sound in your mind if you like. I didn't have any idea he was getting in, although I thought that the Brothers Dynamite were going to get in, and I thought that Ted Turner had a shot. I thought Junkyard Dog had a shot. Obviously, they didn't get in. I did not have George Kidd, and I had the wrong Briscoe Brothers. I thought there'd be more of a groundswell for the modern Briscoe Brothers because of, you know, mourning a death and them having now an end to whatever era of their tag team work, you know, closes the door, obviously. And maybe they will get in eventually. They didn't trend as high as I thought they would either. But the old-fashioned Briscoe brothers, Jack and Jerry Briscoe, are in the Hall of Fame. And I didn't quite realize that they weren't in yet either. So that is a wrap-up on where we are with the Hall of Fame and the Hall of Fame tracker and what we plan to do over the next year for Morris Siegel and for Sylvester Ritter, the Junkyard Dog. So now we get to the main event as we go through. And boy, I have been chatty this episode, so we're going to run a little long so that we can still get the Ernie Ladd stuff in. But let's just go through real quick. Not even real quick. We'll go a few minutes extra. Friday, September 19th, 1969, Houston, Texas. Regardless of whether Johnny Valentine wins the world title tonight, he will meet Wahoo McDaniel here next Friday night. No title involved, exclamation point. Just revenge, exclamation point. Indian strap match. Here we go. Wahoo McDaniel carrying two straps in a photo for the 1970s, that is iconic in my mind now. And here's what it says. Whether Johnny Valentine becomes world heavyweight champion tonight or not, he will step into the ring here next Friday night against the all-out assault of the great Indian athlete Wahoo McDaniel in a continuation of their wild and bloody feud that erupted into full flame again last week. Valentine, in a fit of rage when Grizzly Smith and Wahoo combined to leave him with no choice but to meet Wahoo in a workout last week, insisted that the first man I want after I finished with the champion is that crazy Indian. Promoter Paul Bosch took him at his word, produced the contract, and signed the match even before the big blonde left the dressing room. Wahoo, who is well pleased with the scrap and admits he inserted himself into Johnny's workout for the purpose of humiliating him into a match, set the terms. At first, he wanted a strap match, but then he settled for the next best thing. If a third fall is needed to settle the issue, that fall will be wrestled in Indian strap match style with both men linked by the 8-foot strip of rawhide. And Wahoo also knows that if Valentine wins tonight, a match with the world champion, whether the title is up or not, is a chance to become the uncrowned champion and to force a title match. It's like, yeah, the NWA title is going to be on the line tonight. The champion is coming to town September 19th. But guess what, guys? Next week, whatever happens tonight, Wahoo and Johnny V are going to beat the living crap out of each other. I said to John when we were talking about this program, because I showed him, because I was posting it all over the place the other day, you can almost still hear Wahoo and Johnny Valentine chopping each other. Like, that feud took place in the 1960s and 1970s all over Texas, and you can almost still hear them chopping each other if you listen closely. And then the other thing I said is, you know, if heaven really exists, you know what I'm going to be able to do? Go to every Friday night card at the Coliseum in order for the rest of my heaven life, right? Like, can you imagine? So here is, I'm going to skip the girls wrestlers next week part and just open up and look at page 2 for tonight's card. So in the opener, Grizzly Smith, 440 pounds from Alaska, wrestles the Bulldog. I think that's Danny Plesius. I think that's how you say his name. 260 pounds at Omaha, Nebraska. Tony Gonzalez versus Thunderbolt Patterson. Tony Gonzalez, 220 from Mexico. T-Bolt, 260 from Waterloo, Iowa. The mysterious Moon Man. I'm not sure who he is in cage match. Does not have a full listing on him. Will wrestle Salento Rodriguez, 218 pounds from Mexico City. We got nothing on the Moon Man, a.k.a. the Bushman. But looking at his picture, he looks like Tarzan with a sword and a little bit like Bruiser Brody in the head and with the hair and beard. And I'm going to guess that it was not a good night for Rodriguez. So in the special event, Texas State girls title, Evelyn Stevens, champion, 138 pounds, Minneapolis, gets Maria De Leon, 135 pounds, Mexico, challenger. One fall, no time limit. And in the semifinal, Gary Hart, 220 pounds from Chicago versus Wahoo McDaniel, 240 Midland. Two out of three falls, 40-minute time limit. And of course, two out of three falls, 90-minute time limit. The champion, Dory Funk Jr. from Umbarger, Texas, against the challenger, Johnny Valentine, 260 pounds, Seattle, Washington. Not a bad card at all, right? And since we are short on time, maybe we will hold. Like I said, I don't have the September 19th results, but what I do have is a program from a few weeks later, which is not right in front of my face, but the beginning of October 1969. So it does make reference to what happens in the 2 out of 3 falls strap match, which, as you can guess, is won by Wahoo McDaniel. Let's see. On the back of the program, Nick Kozak to return. Popular Nick Kozak returns to his second home within the very near future, and we'll see action here in Houston during the month of October. Nick has been going great guns since he was here last and turned in a great job in Florida, where he won the Florida state title. From there, he went to the Panhandle. Ooh, that evil Panhandle. And has been keeping with the North Texas area, jumping with his always fast-moving, crowd-pleasing style. He expects to come back here in top condition, ready for anyone who wants a tough match. Now, on Twice, Houston Wrestling with Paul Bosch as your host on Channel 39, America's leading independent UHF in color, Saturday night, 10 to 11:30, Sunday afternoon, 3 to 4:30. Not bad for 1969, right? Like, this is the whole era where they lose MSG crowds because they don't have TV in New York, if I remember correctly. All right, here's the ticket prices tonight at the door. Ringside, $350. Boxes, $350. Dress circle, $3. General circle, $250. Balcony, $150. And children under 12 in the balcony, $1. Other sections, half price. Is that amazing? And as I say, don't miss the sizzling action next Friday in the Coliseum, because we are coming back with Wahoo, who's got next with Stips and Straps. That was like the alternative title to this episode. Let me just do a quick run through and make sure there's nothing else. Let me just read you guys about the Moon Man. Moon Man, or if you would prefer, Bushman, is probably the most unique wrestler in the world today in more ways than one. Most certainly no man has created as much of a stir in a short time as he has, and most of it all is because of his extraordinary physical appearance. Much of it is due to his in-ring action. Whether he has been lost or driven into exile by the actions of promoter Paul Bosch, as Gary Hart claims, is a moot point. Hart has never been one to allow an opportunity to capitalize on a situation slip past him. But there are rumors around now that he is having his troubles, that his advocacy of Moon Man and Spoiler 3 have roused the wrath of Spoiler 1, who is due back from Japan shortly. And the rumor says that a showdown may be due between Spoiler 1 and Hart. Only a rumor, but a strong one. All right, now let me read you one more thing, and then we'll get to our Ernie Ladd story, R-rated. You guys, if you don't want an R-rated story, turn this off after I read this next story from the Houston program. World champion Dory Funk Jr. faces Johnny Valentine with 90-minute limit. Exclamation point. There's a great picture of Dory with a hat, cowboy hat, and his belt and his jacket. Then there's a picture of Johnny Valentine looking hair crazy, eyes crazy, the challenger who rates as the toughest. World heavyweight champion Dory Funk Jr. still has a vivid memory of his clash here with Johnny Valentine in mid-August, ended after 16 grueling minutes. Yet, with the courage of youth and the strength of his convictions, he agreed to the NWA edict that tonight's match be lengthened to 1.5 hours. And he did it without a whimper. "The way I feel," said young Dory, "I hold the NWA belt and title. If they ask me to meet someone on the moon, I'll try to go defend the title there. I know that I am taking a chance when I meet Valentine with a 90-minute limit, and I am well aware that a champion looks on the time limit as a safeguard. But I don't want to be champion unless I can beat any man in the world at the time." Funk knows that he can hold his title tonight without a win. It will take a loss to take it away from him, but the chances of a draw helping him are remote. The time limit is a long ways off when that opening bell rings. And the man who is even more aware of it is Valentine. "Now I have the young pretender to the throne where I want him. I have him on my hands, and I will twist and turn him into a defeated, beaten, tireless ex-champion. I will show him respect for experience, and I will show him that experience is the best weapon of all, and that I have it." Both men are primed for an all-out battle, and it should be a good one. regardless of whether Valentine comes out of this match as champion tonight or not, he will face, stop me if you've heard this one already, Wahoo McDaniel in next week's main event. So just going around the rest of the page, there's a story about the women, Maria and Evelyn. There's a story about Grizzly Smith, who's opening the card, saying that he backs Wahoo McDaniel. Apparently they both were in on Johnny V's workouts to get ready for his NWA title match, and Wahoo embarrassed Valentine a little bit. And it says, midget wrestlers, sorry, but that's what they called them, in action soon, right above Jack's beer ad. And then there's an article about Sensational International Pair to debate, to debut here October 3rd, exclamation point. And they are one of the biggest pairs of the 70s. Actually, one of the biggest heels of the 70s and his manager, I guess you'd say. The Great Malenko and Sir Chaz Montague, if that's how you pronounce it. Montague. Anyway, so that is the program for Friday, September 19th, 1969, Houston, Texas. Paul Bosch promoter, Houston Athletic Club. And now we're right on time. So we did an old-fashioned main event, but this is the chaser. As you're walking out, you get a little interview or autograph because you see one of the wrestlers, but this is R-rated. So here's trigger warning number 3. I think I just gave the second one, right? This is an R-rated story about Ernie Ladd. So please, please, please don't let your kids hear this, and please, please, please turn this off if you're going to be offended. Sorry about my words, but you guys know how I feel about words. Words are just words. Words shouldn't offend so much that, you know, our egos get involved. I know sometimes people call us words we don't like and don't take as ours or us. And sometimes you guys call me words too. And it was funny when Dave was like, I don't know who told Dave to be a jerk on Twitter. People suspect it was Brian Alvarez. Hey, you got to be a heel. Heel, brother, heel. Anyway, I don't know what it was, but I don't like that, Dave. I really don't. And I'm not into that. But, you know, when he starts like retweeting your tweets for his fans to jump on you and then you point it out, he's like, oh, look who's playing the victim. And it's like, no, Dave, I'm pointing out when somebody's being a bully. And you know the funny thing about being a bully? Before we get to the R-rated lesson, here's the life lesson or the R-rated story. You know how they say if you punch a bully in the face, they go away? That's not exactly true. The bully's still there. They just whine and they cry and they flail and they make threats and they get more aggressive sometimes. Sometimes you have to punch the bully 2 or 3 times. And this isn't necessarily Dave, although, well, I guess what I would say is once. Fool me once, right? Happen once. Anyway, to move on. But my point was just, you know, it's not exactly true that the bully goes away right away. You have to keep standing up to the bully. That's the life lesson. You can't just do it once and think all of your troubles go away. You have to now have a little bit more confidence when you face the bully that you can stare them down. And if that has to do with Evad, you know, Mizelt Zizzer, then so be it. But we're going to work it a different way with the Hall of Fame this year and see if that works. We're going to work in the system with the voters. In any event, this is an R-rated story. Turn it off now. I've now given you 4 warnings. So my last matches were in Ohio for Jerry Gray in 1997. The first one was at the, you know, in Warren, Ohio at the Packard Music Hall. I think that's right. Could be Packard, Ohio at the Warren Music Hall. But anyway, so, and then the second one was in the Coliseum in Canton, where the Sheik used to run. I mean, I asked Jerry what was the biggest, Jerry asked me first. He said, what was the biggest place you ever wrestled? I said, I don't know, Jerry, you tell me. So he said, well, it's got to be Canton, because that's the arena that the Sheik used to run. So my last match was in Canton. The night before that, we wrestled in Warren, and somewhere in the Canton, Akron area, we stayed the night. And I stayed in a room with the announcer, Mr. Announcer. It's important to this story. So he was the ring announcer. And it was really cool because it was really like the show in Delaware that I did for him in 97 at the State Fair was his first State Fair show. And that's when his business model changes. And the show in Cleveland that I did for him was Back Home. They were his annual Back Home going to see his mom shows. So he hired the ring announcer from Buffalo. You know, Buffalo, Cleveland being one of the territories, right? And this guy had just done the Ilio DiPaolo anniversary show. So he was all filled up with stories and Ilios and this and that and telling me about Ilio and who he was and what he did at the show. And we're just having all these fun conversations. And apparently, at one point in time, he was in a room very similar to, I guess, except that none of these shenanigans went on with me or him while we were in Ohio this weekend. But at one point, he was rooming with Ernie Ladd on an Ilio DiPaolo show. Or maybe it was Ernie came in. It couldn't have been that Ernie came in late 1997. This has to be like a 1970s story. So anyway, he's telling me this story of how he's rooming with Ernie and he walks into the room. But he walks into the room at the wrong time. There should have been a tie on the door or a sock on the door. Or maybe he should have been listening for the clues. But he walks in and he catches Ernie. What is the term? In flagus interruptus? Is it something like that? He catches Ernie in the middle of the act. The act is what we might think of today as third base. But the third base is being done by a completely naked Ernie Ladd, who has a much smaller, presumably blonde-haired woman pinned against the headboard. And we can leave it to your imagination what he's pinning her with. But of course, it's third base, right? So it's literally in her mouth. And Ernie says, "Mr. Announcer, she's fixin' to have cum in her mouth." And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my R-rated Ernie Ladd story. Thank you to announcer whose name I don't know, who we roomed together for like one night in Ohio, and I had the best time just hanging out and telling wrestling stories and possibly smoking something of substance. And the funny thing is, Brutus Beefcake worked on this show, and he only knew me by my doink outfit. So when I saw him at like the soft drink and snack area of the hotel and said, "Hey, Beefcake," and he said, "Hey," like, I didn't think to think that he didn't know me by my face. And maybe if I had just said, "Hey, Beefcake, we're, you know, got some weed in the other room. You want to come in?" He might have come in and I might have made a connection and I might have had a longer career or maybe even gone to WCW in 1998 or 1999 as partners of the Booty Man or something. But a missed opportunity and yet a really great weekend as I ended up ending my wrestling career wrestling for Jerry Gray in a couple of matches in Ohio and got to hear this gem of an Ernie Ladd story, which hopefully you didn't let your kids hear. Because it was a little R-rated. In any event, thank you guys for this episode. It's been a lot of fun, covered a lot of ground. And I will say, man, as I start to catalog the Houston programs that I have and go through the years that I have almost completed, and by almost I mean half or less, but still, you know, that's better than nuns, right? Like, I mean, there's significant years where I have 10 or more programs. And some of the programs I have are amazing. And there's so many different angles for future shows. And I'll just leave that as a teaser, you know, in terms of first Mil Máscaras, first Billy Graham and Andre, Billy Graham and Patera, and then all of this Parade of Champions stuff that I've been talking about, including the one for Paul Bosch that I'll put up in a couple of months when we get back from the other side of some 1983 Mid-South wrestling, which hopefully will be next episode. And then also this Wahoo McDaniel Dory Funk 1970 is fascinating me right now. And it really has made me think about Jack Briscoe saying Jose was the biggest star in Houston. And then thinking about, you know, reading the Burkle's book, who was the biggest star in Houston by the decade. And maybe this will all lead to like a John McAdam like online poll / tournament to determine the biggest star by decade in Houston and the biggest star overall in Houston wrestling history. And while we all think right now it's like Wahoo or Valentine or Jose or one of the big stars of the 70s, you got to consider all the eras, right? You got to consider The Medic and Pepper Gomez. You got to consider Whiskers Savage. You got to consider Dog and Duggan, you know, in the 80s, right? So anyway, fascinating stuff. Thank you guys for taking the ride with me. We're getting out in 110, and hopefully you enjoyed the stories. I will see you next time, episode 38 of Greg Klein's Old School Wrestling Talk.